Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello and welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service and another chance to hear an episode of Heart and Soul from our archive. In this edition, originally published in September 2023, Colm Flynn talks about faith, terrorists and mercy at Guantanamo Bay with Jennifer Bryson, a former interrogator at the infamous US Detention Centre.
I'm walking up to a stunning monastery hidden away in the hills of Austria to meet a woman called Dr. Jennifer Bryson.
Jennifer, great to meet you.
Hi, Colm. Good to see you.
How are you?
I'm doing just fine today.
This monastery we're standing in is called Heiligenkreuz, around 40 minutes south of Vienna, and it's one of the oldest monasteries in the world.
Founded in 1133, we're in the main entry courtyard of the monastery in front of the Abbey Church.
Jennifer is an academic researcher here on a two-year scholarship, translating the work of a mid-20th century German Catholic author.
Her name is Ida Friederike Göris. She's fallen into being forgotten today, but she was a wonderful mid-20th century Catholic author.
Every now and then, we spot one of the cloistered monks walking by with a silent smile and nod of the head.
We're walking through part of the monastery now. Isn't it incredible that this has been here for almost 900 years?
It is, and it's been a continuous monastery the whole time.
Wow, that is incredible. I'll get the door.
It's a lot different to the work that you used to do.
Yes, that's one way to put it.
This is Heart and Soul from the BBC World Service. My name is Colm Flynn, and I've come here to talk to Jennifer, not about her academic work, but how her Catholic faith helped her to make incredibly difficult decisions while she was working as an interrogator with suspected terrorists at Guantanamo Bay.
I'm an American, and I grew up in California in the San Francisco Bay Area. By the time I went to college, I had already been overseas and thought, oh, maybe I'll join the Foreign Service or something like that.
Nobody move. Everything will be okay. Just stay quiet.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, God.
There's another one.
Oh.
Oh my goodness, there's another.
Like the rest of America, Jennifer felt devastated watching the attacks on 9/11.
Horrified, shocked, the fact that there were thousands of people dead. And it wasn't just that there were attacks, but it was also the nature of the attacks, that individuals would fly airplanes into buildings, including buildings where there were civilians, that they hijacked airplanes that were full of innocent civilian passengers. It was, that made it all extra horrifying.
The United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts.
Jennifer had studied and worked in the Middle East, including at the US embassies in Yemen and Egypt, and she had a PhD in Arabic and Islamic studies from Yale University. After 9/11, she went to work for the US government at the Defense Intelligence Agency in Washington, D.C.
I was informed one day that my next assignment would be to become an interrogator. I would be deployed to Guantanamo. I was interested in working to serve my country, defend my country. I thought, well, talking to people to gather information would be one way to do this.
And Jennifer, did any part of you feel uneasy about going to Guantanamo Bay? Because the base had been open for a few years at this point when you went in 2004. So surely you must have heard some stories from the base or read the reports from groups like Amnesty International or the UN about human rights violations and so on.
Well, I was informed that I was going to become an interrogator in August 2003. So at this point, Guantanamo as a detention facility had been open for just over a year and a half. There was actually very little public information. And I understood that my job was going to be to go and have conversations with these men to gather information.
And when you arrived, there were hundreds, isn't that right? I know today there are around 30 left, but when you were there, there was several hundred. From what kind of countries?
They were from many different countries. One out of every four detainees in Guantanamo was from Saudi Arabia. And a key thing was that many of those who were at Guantanamo had been in the Al-Qaeda training camps. They had a tremendous network of training camps in Afghanistan in the late 90s and up to 2001. And my assignment was to be the team chief, to be in charge of the interrogators and the interrogation analysts for the Saudi detainees. And so my life was all Saudi all the time.
Jennifer was in her early 30s when she arrived at Guantanamo Bay and made a little bit of history by being the first non-military and first female lead interrogator.
So we've got two runners on base and there's one out so far.
Today she's playing American baseball with some of the seminarians here at the monastery, a world apart from her old job and the young men from Saudi Arabia she would talk with in a small room, normally over a cup of tea, and try and understand their way of thinking.
The detainee in the interrogation room would generally have one ankle that was chained to an eye bolt on the floor, and that was for the safety of the interrogator. And we did have instances of some detainees trying to jump the interrogators. The guards had a camera in which they were watching the interrogations going on in the different rooms.
But they wouldn't be in the room with you.
The guards were not in the room, but the guards were in the same building in sort of a control room where they could watch the videos.
The men and the boys that you spoke to from Saudi Arabia, what were they like?
They were guys. These were sometimes young men. The younger ones we had would have been maybe 20 or so.
Did they respect you as a woman?
Yes. The detainees respected women when women behaved in a way that the detainees felt, from their cultural perspective, was serious and honorable. I would always dress modestly. If a detainee wanted to, for example, intentionally try to get me upset, for example, by gloating about how great 9/11 was, and some of them were very thrilled by it. One detainee I had been friends with one of the hijackers, and he was very proud of what
his friend. So he would speak about that to your face? And
oh, yes. Yes.
And what kind of things would he say about it?
How he was disappointed that he had not been a suicide attacker. And he was truly proud of what his friend had done.
What was it like to be sitting across from these men who would tell you that they were glad to see Americans perish? All 3,000 that died on 9/11, they would be happy to see more die. They would be happy to see you die and your colleagues. What's it like talking to someone like that?
At one level, it's upsetting. However, a key part of the interrogation training that I'd had was that I would need to learn to leave myself outside of the interrogation room.
You leave your emotions at the door.
Exactly. My role there as an interrogator was not to try to change their opinions. It wasn't to try to so-called deprogram them from terrorism. My role was to gather information.
And these men, driven primarily by their understanding, their interpretation of Islam?
Yes, however, it's essential to understand how each individual got involved in these movements. Individuals don't just wake up one morning and have a flash of an radical ideology in their head out of a vacuum and suddenly want to go out and run and kill people. There's always a human story. One detainee had felt like he was just failing in life, and he was drinking a lot of alcohol, and he was looked down on by his extended family and his tribe because of this, whereas a cousin of his had fought for Al-Qaeda in a previous jihad in another location, and everybody in the town looked up to that cousin.
They admired him, okay.
And so this young man wanted people to look up to him. This is a human feeling of a young man growing up. And so he began to want to try to emulate his cousin, and then it was through his relationship with his cousin and those social circles that he then began to hear about the ideas of Al-Qaeda and then began to accept these ideas. And there were many other complicated individual background stories like that.
Hallo, hier sind Julia und Chris vom Podcast Drinnies. Wir machen nicht nur einen Comedy-Podcast, sondern gehen auch leidenschaftlich gerne nicht zu Stoßzeiten in den Supermarkt. Ehrlich gesagt bleibe ich am liebsten ganz zu Hause und ziehe nur eine Hose an, wenn es klingelt. Wenn es euch auch so geht, dann ist HelloFresh genau das Richtige für euch. Der Kochbox-Lieferservice bringt euch frische, abwechslungsreiche Gerichte direkt vor die Haustür, die ihr im Handumdrehen selbst zubereiten könnt.
Und mit dem Code LECKER24 könnt ihr jetzt richtig sparen. In Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro, in Österreich bis zu 130 Euro und in der Schweiz bis zu 140 Franken. Also Code LECKER24 eingeben und sparen.
PS, der panierte Portobello-Pilz mit Sweet Chili Ketchup ist sehr gut.
You're listening to Heart and Soul from the BBC World Service. I'm Colm Flynn, and I'm talking to Dr. Jennifer Bryson about her time serving as an interrogator at the infamous Guantanamo Bay and how her faith shaped the incredibly difficult decisions she would have to make.
Und euch, Brüder und Schwestern, für mich zu beten bei Gott, unserem Herrn.
Today, Jennifer has a very strong faith and now in Austria gets to attend Mass daily in the Abbey, all in German, of course. But when she was at Guantanamo Bay, she claimed her faith was weak at a time, as you'll hear shortly, when she had to make some serious moral decisions and really examine her conscience.
I'll have an Americano, please.
Americano, sure. For you?
I'll take an Americano as well, please.
Okay, two Americanos.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
Is the coffee good here?
Yes.
It's so fascinating to hear you talk about conscience and having a well-formed, or what you say, faith-formed conscience. First of all, what is a faith-formed conscience?
Conscience is how we try to orient our decisions to be in line with what God's will is.
Thank you very much. Sorry, Jennifer.
What's really important, and what I did not understand when I went to Guantanamo and only began to understand later, but wish I had understood when I was at Guantanamo, is that forming one's faith to be able to understand and have some knowledge of God's will requires tremendous time and investment. Forming conscience also involves regular prayer and learning to pray more deeply. I think today, if new challenges were to come my way, that I would try to have a slower decision-making process. But I say that while you and I are sitting here in the peaceful, beautiful situation of this outdoor garden at the restaurant, and it's easy to say in this setting. Whereas I remember back when I was at Guantanamo, in the moment, time was not a luxury we had. The pressure to move quickly, move on, and keep working was incredibly intense.
When did you start to feel uneasy and uncomfortable with some of the methods that were being put in front of you, some of the suggested methods from the other interrogators?
This started very early after I got to Guantanamo the first time in 2004 as a supervisor. Because when I arrived there, there were already some interrogators on my team who were using a way of interrogating that involved putting a detainee into a darkened room with strobe lights and music that I can only describe as extremely unpleasant. I would call it headbanger music.
So deafening music and strobe lighting.
Yeah, I immediately, when I saw these plans, felt something's wrong here.
So your gut told you this isn't fair. There's something not right about this.
I was not only confused professionally because this was outside of what the U.S. military taught us to do in interrogation. I also, just as a human being, as a person, as an individual, as Jennifer, felt there's just something wrong with this. But at the same time, the pure pressure to go along with what everybody else was doing.
And to play devil's advocate, Jennifer, of course, in the ordinary course of things, we never want people who are convicted or accused of crimes to be treated in these harsh ways. But do you ever think that there are exceptional circumstances like post 9/11 when they believe there could be other terrorist attacks being planned and would be perpetrated on American soil, killing many more Americans? Are there ever cases when the heat can be turned up, when the U.S. can use what they call the enhanced interrogation techniques?
You're really opening Pandora's box. Who's going to decide when the limits can be removed? Who's going to decide how far the limits can be stretched? There's a lot of ambiguities there that open up opportunities for abuse. Also, if we look at the experience of the U.S. military in multiple conflicts, Vietnam, Grenada, First Gulf War, Panama, again and again and again, the interrogators experienced that rapport building was what worked.
When we talk about showing compassion and mercy to the detainees, again, with people listening to this now, particularly in the United States, many of them would be of the mind, having 9/11 still fresh in their mind, they do not deserve compassion or mercy. They did not show it to us in any shape or form.
With the detainees who are being questioned, I think the question is that we need to consider their humanity and simply that they are human beings. But there are others involved in this situation. One group of people involved in this situation is the civilian population that can be protected by excellence in intelligence collection. They also deserve compassion and mercy. And then there is a third group that very seldom is considered in this situation, and that's the interrogator. What are you asking the interrogator to do? Every interrogation I have ever conducted in my life stays with me until I die. And I am a Catholic, and I fully believe that someday I will meet my Maker and need to give an account for my life. And I believe that all other interrogators, too, will have to do so. And so we also need to consider whether or not approaches that are being proposed are dragging the interrogator not only into deep moral corruption, but also, I would say, cruel trauma.
When you talk about having a faith-formed conscience, and I know when I asked you about going there in the first place, why did you even want to go if you knew about or if you'd heard some things about what was happening there? But when you were there and then you saw some of the interrogation techniques that they were trying to do, God knows what was happening that you weren't aware of, why did you want to stay? Why didn't you just get up and leave and say, I don't want to be part of this?
Well, first, I want to address the suggestion that there were even more other things going on that I didn't know about. I had no evidence that there were other worse things going on. And
do you think there was torture?
No.
No.
I never had any experience or knowledge of torture at Guantanamo. But these methods that these interrogators were proposing to me were harsh.
In 2006, Jennifer left Guantanamo Bay to take up a new assignment in the Department of Defense. How did your faith change over the 2 years when you were there?
My faith grew while I was there and became a bit more solid. Hmm. And there were several influences on that. One was In my first tour there, this friend of mine I mentioned, whom I consulted when I was trying to make a tough decision, he invited me to go to Mass. And I didn't mention to him, oh, I haven't been going to Mass lately. Instead, I thought, this is a good opportunity. And so I said, sure. And so I went to Mass regularly while I was there. It also helped me that we had a community, something I had not found in parish life in the U.S. A group of us would have brunch together after Mass on Sundays. Also, the incredibly intense, demanding experience of interrogation with the Saudi detainees, as I mentioned, was just an encounter in what it means to be a human being.
Jennifer, how did it make you think about religion? Because religion, so much in the air there at Guantanamo Bay and just in the room with those men from Saudi Arabia.
I saw, for one thing, in the detainees that the role of religion in their individual lives varied from detainee to detainee. They were definitely not clones of each other. They weren't some sort of terrorist robots all exactly approaching their religion identically in the same way. I also became aware, for some of them, ways that their faith helped to give them support and orientation during a difficult time in their lives. And one detainee, for example, I knew invested a great deal of time in improving his Quran memorization and his Quran recitation.
Jennifer is adamant that while she did witness what she calls harsh treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay, she never witnessed torture, and in her 2 years, never saw anything to suggest torture. Now, the international human rights group Amnesty International recently said that Guantanamo Bay had become a symbol of torture and indefinite detention of people without charge or trial. Did it make you question your faith and belief in the institution of the Catholic Church in terms of overall religion being a force for good or force for bad in the world?
No. But I have to say that being an interrogator was one of the, if not the most radical experiences I've had in life with what it means to be a human being.
What a beautiful evening it is, Jennifer.
A lovely summer evening, pleasant.
Now, this is beautiful. What is this? We're walking up onto the small wooden bridge.
So this is a little wooden bridge that connects the seminary here in Heiligenkreuz to the School of Theology and to some of the seminary housing. And this little wooden bridge crosses over a small river called the Sadelbach.
Oh, wow. Look at this.
And this flows into one stream that then flows into the Danube.
It is so quaint and so beautiful. It's like something out of a movie.
It's peaceful.
When we were chatting earlier, Jennifer, you mentioned that your experience at Guantanamo was the most radical in your life. And you said that it taught you what it meant to be human. What did you mean by that?
Spending those 2 years talking with the detainees, having tea, having long conversations, being able to sit in a room with somebody who's hostile to me, even has expressed wishes to kill me and my colleagues, it makes one realize we're all human beings on the same planet, with our feet on the same ground. And when I was talking to the detainees and I was there to learn about them, I had to really think about who they were as people, as human beings. And also I wondered sometimes, what do they think of me? Who do they think I am?
But when you say it taught you what it meant to be human, do you mean that part of existing is that we have the good and the bad, we have our friends, we have our enemies, it's kind of part of life?
Being an interrogator at Guantanamo definitely heightened my awareness of the reality of evil as part of human life. But it isn't the totality of human life. Every human being has the capacity for evil and for good. And I think that's also part of what I realized in that experience of encountering being human at some sort of fundamental level.
Do you ever think about the detainees now, the men that you met, where they are, what they're doing?
I do. And in the years since Guantanamo, I've wondered sometimes what is my responsibility? What am I supposed to do? And one of the things my faith helped me realize is I can pray for my enemies. And as a Christian, not only can I pray for my enemies, but I have an obligation to pray for my enemies.
Isn't it amazing, Jennifer, that as we stand here on this beautiful small wooden bridge at the Abbey in the hills of Austria, right this very moment, on the other side of the world, there are still, I think, around 30 men detained at Guantanamo Bay. And the US government is holding these military trials at the moment, seeking the death penalty for many of them. If Jesus was here today, would Jesus want the death penalty, or would he be calling for mercy and compassion?
I don't know. I think always that mercy, to be authentic, must go hand in hand with justice, and justice, to be authentic, has some sort of a relationship to mercy. The two are not contrary.
And what about forgiveness, Jennifer? Because Jesus always asks Christians to forgive in all circumstances. I know it sounds like a bizarre question, but are Christians called to forgive the men in Guantanamo Bay, the men who helped, for example, organize 9/11?
I don't think it's a bizarre question. I think it's a necessary question for Catholics to be asking. Yes, we're called to forgive, but learning to forgive can take a lifetime. And in the meantime, one of the things I know I can do and that I do is I pray for the detainees, because we are called to pray for our enemies.
You've been listening to a conversation with Dr. Jennifer Bryson. This is Heart and Soul from the BBC World Service. And for me, Colm Flynn, thank you for listening.